Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck, and you're listening to Tall Stories on Monocle 24, brought to you by the team behind The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Opened in 1959, Ronnie Scott's has been bringing some of the best jazz performers and singers to London for decades. This week, our own Daphne Karnesis peeks behind the curtain to tell us the story of one of Soho's most iconic venues.
Jazz is dead, say some. If it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense. The genre isn't for everyone, and it never sold albums like rock did, nor do jazz musicians pack stadiums full of thousands. But the continued presence of small yet thriving jazz clubs across the world show the debate is far from over. Case in point, Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Walk along Soho's Old Compton Street, known as the focal point of London's LGBT community, and turn onto Frith Street. A few metres along, you'll notice a black sign with neon light writing in red, blue and green, depicting a saxophone and the words, Ronnie Scott's, open nightly, 6:30 p.m. to 3 a.m. Let's take a walk inside.
I'm Simon Cook, and I am the managing director of Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club.
This is as classic a jazz club as you will find in appearance and feel and atmosphere. It's a small club, holds 220, but the amount of support, I mean, I've got about 40 staff working every night to make this work. The club's been around for 58, 59 years, so virtually everybody who you've heard of in jazz has played here.
Say, love me, leave me, let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else.
Ella Fitzgerald, Nina Simone, Stan Getz, and Buddy Rich are some of the jazz legends that have graced the Ronnie Scott stage. Their black and white framed portraits cover the club's walls. But who was Ronnie Scott?
Ronnie was a tenor saxophone player, probably the best known in Britain back in the 50s. But one of the gigs he used to get was working on the orchestra on the cross-Atlantic steamships. And they would go to New York and he would work in the band on the ship. And then he'd have 36 hours in New York, and then he had to get back on the ship and come back to Southampton. And he used to use those 36 hours to basically go to all the jazz clubs in New York and go and see all these jazz stars of the day, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, maybe. So he got this idea that he wanted a club like all the clubs he was going to see, because he was going to all the, you know, the Village Vanguard and all those sort of places in New York. So he wanted to open his own. So he came back and eventually opened his own jazz club.
It wasn't an easy start, especially when it came to attracting jazz talent beyond British shores. British jazz fans in the late 1940s and 50s had virtually no chance of hearing American jazzmen in person.
They started off just being able to play British jazz because the British Musicians Union wouldn't allow Americans to come and play over here, and the Americans wouldn't let the British go and play over there because they were protectionist. And it was actually Pete King, Ronnie's partner, who negotiated a one-in, one-out deal, so that if we took an American here, the Americans had to take a British player over there. So Ronnie's, they managed to negotiate this between the two unions. So we started getting American players to come over here, but they would have to play with British guys. And that's how it started, that they brought in American artists, and that was a really big deal to have all these big star names. We have five people who meet every Wednesday and go through what's the headline bookings for the club. All got fiercely independent points of view as to what should and shouldn't be in here, so it's quite good fun. We like to be 3 months ahead with shows on sale. It kind of depends who wants a show as well. There are some artists who want, well, there's a lot of artists who want shows, but we won't book them that far ahead. But there are other artists who, if they say, can I have June the 12th, 2019, we'll let them have it.
Today, the club enjoys fully booked nights, over two houses and a late, late show nearly every day of the year. The club did go through some rocky years after 2006, when it underwent an expensive renovation by French architect Jacques Garcia. something managing director Simon Cook fixed with a small but important change to the booking system.
There was a kind of rigidity to who played and for how many nights. And I changed that and just said, we will book an act for as long as they can sell a full house and not longer. Because I think the best marketing is word of mouth. People come in and they have a great time. They're going to go away and they're going to tell people tomorrow, because that's what we do. And personal recommendation. People hear it twice. They go, it's time I went down there.
Smaller music spots like Ronnie Scott's create an intimacy between artists and their fans, perhaps unlike any other music venue. Just like jazz music's underpinning improvisation, Ronnie Scott's isn't afraid to adapt and experiment, but it's also certain of what's been a winning repertoire so far.
Someone was saying to me the other day, all busy bars, oh, they redesign themselves every 6 years, but this'll look like this in 10 years' time.
On the sunny side of the street.
You've been listening to Tall Stories, a Monocle 24 production. Our thanks to Daphne Karnesis for today's episode. And remember, tune in every Thursday for the full 30-minute edition of The Urbanist. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, city lovers.